Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how the companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast series, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. And without further ado, let's get to today's episode. It's my pleasure to have Greg Hayden, CEO and founder of Ethos Engineering, with me today. Having qualified as a chartered engineer, Greg held jobs in the UK and Ireland with various engineering companies before returning to the role of managing director of RPS's engineering business in Ireland. During his three-year tenure as managing director, he guided the business from €16 million in revenue to €24 million and helped grow the staff numbers to 300 people. Then, in 2005, he went out on his own, setting up Ethos Engineering and becoming its CEO. Ethos is Ireland's largest mechanical electrical consultancy and one of Europe's leading experts in data centre design, sustainability, urbanism, global tech and digital services, or smart buildings. With a HQ in Dublin, a regional office in Galway, work sites in 17 countries across Europe and Africa, and over 160 staff, Ethos, with its engineering wow philosophy, has an absolute commitment to treat each project as completely bespoke with no preordained solutions. They drive technology innovation, embracing new, improved ways of working to deliver the best results and go beyond to the next level of delivering the most sustainable, energy-efficient buildings that fully focus on end-user experiences. Greg, you're very welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for joining me.
Aidan, thank you for the invite. I'm delighted to be here with you today.
Great. Well, before we get into the nitty-gritty on the company, let's talk about the industry more generally. And, you know, we're obviously in, we're seeing it all the time about smart buildings, wave sustainability, and, you know, the it's not just about data centres. It's every building now is getting that way, isn't it?
Yeah, data for me is the way forward. There's huge opportunities in construction for the use of data. For us, designers, we're mechanical, electrical designers primarily. It's changing the way we're designing. We're designing now for performance more than just compliance. We're designing based on building user experience. And data monitoring and analysis to optimize the use of buildings.
There is that huge idea out there that a building used to be just a building that you happen to go into and out of, but now it's almost become an asset of the company in terms of, you know, trying to make sure that it's efficient, but also then, you know, in how it performs, what it needs to perform.
Yeah, it needs to perform for the people that use the buildings first and foremost. So we have to make the best space that's people will get the best out of the building and workers will get the best environment to perform in. There's huge opportunities there in using data to find out how we use our buildings. I'd like to say if myself and yourself live next door to each other and we built exactly the same house, how you would use your house and how I would use my house is totally different. If we were then to monitor that using IoT technology and then feed that back into a loop to get you to optimize or to get the building to optimize how it functions in the way you use it, it's going to be different than the way I use it. So your requirement to use your building will be different than my requirement to use my building, even if the buildings are exactly the same.
And then do you get a thing where because obviously you have a lot of customers who you do big repeat business for. As you build each new or design each new building for those people, are you learning from what happened in the first building to maybe tweak the design in the second building and the third building and the fourth building?
Yes, but clients have different requirements from the buildings, and it's writing a storyboard based on the way the client wants to use their buildings. And from one client to the other, that's going to be different.
Even in the same industry?
Even in the same industry.
Yeah.
Now, there is knowledge that we pick up along the way, and we know what has actually worked very well from one building to the next. And we can actually share that where, you know, we're in the commercial fit-out sectors. We can actually share that with our clients and say, this has worked somewhere else. Very, very good. This may suit you.
All right. When you look at the industry overall, like it is a, you know, your industry is a really kind of specific or a technical industry, right? So, you know, the idea that you have, you know, as a company, a kind of a clarity of purpose in terms of, you know, it might well be, as we said, you know, building the best, most sustainable building for, and the right building for that client. But how important is that clarity of purpose for you as a CEO running the business, but also for your customers to know that you have that kind of clarity of purpose?
Yeah, I suppose it depends what sector we're in. If we talk about the data center sector, our clients are very, very clear what they are actually looking for. They're building data centers all around the world. They're getting smarter at each time. So for us then, it's the pedigree that we have brought to that in the experience that we have over the last 18 years in the data center sector. For another sector, in the commercial sector, a client may not know exactly what they want, and they're relying on us more to bring some ideas to that sector for the best use of their building or their asset.
And are the data center guys at the kind of the forefront, and as they push the boundary and push the boundary, there's kind of a ripple effect back that you bring that experience that you may have learned from the data center guys to other buildings?
Well, I think one can feed the other. Yeah. On the commercial side of things, it's probably very commercially driven. On the data center side of things, it's very functionally driven, and it's about mission critical. It's about, you know, getting rid of single points of failure. But there is one that feeds the other. You'd like to do all that mission critical. You want to do that in a sustainable way. You want to do that in a cost effective way. So this is where sometimes the commercial side can actually feed into the data center side of things, and then vice versa with technology and movement of technology and some smarts that we brought into one sector can translate into another sector.
And, you know, I'm sure it's a few years away, but do you start seeing some of that technology making its way into the residential?
Yeah, it's already happening. It's already happening. We like to think of buildings nearly like our smartphones, that we can actually use them in a smart way. And it goes back to just our opening point. If, you know, if we're living next to each other, how we use the space is going to be different. You want to be able to tweak that space that it provides that user experience for the person that's actually using the space. So if that's a block of apartments that you have 100 families in there, there might be a different experience that, you know, each unit is looking for. Mm-hmm. So if you have that flexibility within the buildings and within the systems, you know, you can get best use out of a building.
Again, going back to that idea of how technical the industry is, do you then have to obsess about the small things?
I could have been accused of doing that, I think, in the early stages of my life. And we've done a number of course. Enterprise Ireland have been fantastic to us over the years. And what we got off them is a number of courses from Leadership for Global for Growth, International Selling. And part of that is, you know, where they bring in some fantastic facilitators, and it's nearly a management course on your business. What had come out at from me was a number of 360s. Yeah. You get a couple of nice pages of where people say nice things about you. I'm sure you experience them yourself.
I have one
and
or
then
two,
you get a lot more of the things that you do wrong, and some of them you don't see yourself, some you do see yourself. And probably one of the things was in my early days, maybe focused too much on the smaller things. I think as I've matured as a business person, I do see the bigger picture more. It's about surrounding myself with fantastic people, much better people than, and much more intelligent people than I'll ever be, and giving them the trust and ability to do their job without interfering and without getting down to the nitty gritty and leaving it with them, and to give them that autonomy. And that has really, really worked well for Etos Engineering.
Developing on from that, and in terms of your approach to staff, where are you in terms of, you know, developing your own or bringing, you know, experienced people into Etos?
Yeah, and we've done a brand relaunch back in 2021, and we had an announcement with 150 new jobs. And And part of that was we needed to bring in teams to help us get from where we are now to where we wanted to go. And up to that stage, we'd done an awful lot ourselves. So we brought in a people and talent team, and they've actually done a superb job. We brought in a strategy and growth team, and again, they've done a superb job. We brought in a marketing team. So these are add-on, we call them enablers. They're really, really smart people, and they're just taking Ethos to another level that we weren't there before. And we're looking back now and saying, how did we do these things before? We're engineers. What do I know about, you know, people and talent, really? What do I know about other areas of business support? I think we've stepped up. We've stepped up with the introduction of these smart people that we've brought in to help us run our company.
The other thing then, leading on from that, when you have that expansion of people and things like that, and the fact that you're in 17 different locations globally and things like that, when you started the business, you probably had in your head the type of culture you wanted in the business. So as you get bigger and bring in non-engineering people, like, because engineers would be all of a similar mindset, as you bring in non-engineering people, and then as you go globally, how have you changed the culture or developed the culture so that you're able to cross, you know, that is there an ethos culture, you know, the wow bit, is that about design or is it also about how you do your business and how people work?
Yeah, maybe when we started first, the magic number in my mind was 50 right. engineers, and probably was to do work not only in Ireland, was outside of Ireland. I never thought we're up to, I think, 172 now. Never thought we'd be up to 172, and the amount of countries that we're in. It's definitely being guided by the support people and systems that we've brought in. To our people and talent team, we looked at a number of pillars that's very important to Ethos, and our culture is wrapped around that, and we call it the Ethos Epic. And the EPIC is excellence, people, innovation, and customers. And if we can get things right within the company based on those four pillars and get them right externally, our culture is based around that.
Okay. There's an idea out there, you know, that customers are great for telling you when things are wrong, but not telling you how to fix them.
Yeah.
Given the nature of your customers, I'd say that's not a problem, is it?
No, and our customers, especially in some of the sectors, again, if I pick the DC sectors, they know what they want. They would have stage gates, you know, at 30% design, 60% design, 90% design before we're even looking to go to the market. So we have our own checks and balances internally, but then we have to present that and do a page turn to the client at any stage. So we're not allowed to go too far wrong. And we stay within the parameters, but always trying to push the envelope at the same time. And it's that there's a fine balance around that.
And the other thing, I suppose, that the company's been hugely successful, and what you see sometimes with companies that have that level of success, there's always a risk of distraction, that you start kind of going off into areas that, you know, might seem like a good idea, but, you know, take you further from your core business. Has that been a problem for you, or how do you get around it?
Yeah, we probably went the other way again with a fantastic facilitator we brought in. She went around and talked to 18 of our clients and asked them what's important for them, asked them how they rate Ethos and what's important that they get from Ethos. Mm-hmm. That allowed us to focus back in, and as you said, rather than have that, you know, too broad of a focus, we were able to home it in a lot better to provide a better service for our clients, mm-hmm. one that they rated, one that was adding value to them. Probably the big thing that came out of it was innovation. They were looking for outside the box thinking, and that's something that we've been driving, a whole culture of innovation for the last number of years, from graduate coming in all the way to myself, a CEO.
And how do you do that? How do you drive that innovation?
Everyone has a voice. Okay. From the time they actually come in, we want to hear What do you think of ETOS? How are they getting on with their job? How can they do their job better? Just because we have a prescribed way of doing things doesn't mean it's the right way to do things. What they're doing day to day, they know that better than us. So ask them, give us ideas of how you can either improve your own work life, make things easier about working smarter and not harder. Can you give us ideas that will make your job easier, or give us ideas that will actually add better value to our client? And we have an innovation wall. We've a BI power that sits over that. We get all of our staff to offer ideas to the innovation wall. We collect those ideas and see, can they go through to something that we're going to change? Mm-hmm. Now, not all things do end up with a change, but they're all considered. So people feel they're part of the whole system. They feel that they have a say. And that's how we do it in ETOS.
And then, you know, innovation is one side of it, but obviously, you know, the need to be very focused on what you're doing. Because again, going back to the nature of the business, the nature of the industry that you're in is a technical one. So you have innovation on the one side of it, but also you need to be kind of focused on the, you know, the stuff that moves the needle.
Yeah, and I think with that, when we got Mark Gallagher over to talk to our staff from Formula One. Mm-hmm. And you think of Formula One, how can you innovate in that sector that's so, so innovative? And it's, you know, things have been checked backward and forward to death that you think there's no room for innovation. And some of the lessons that you look at a sector like that and say, well, if you can bring that to construction, because construction is absolutely ripe for innovation, mm-hmm. and you can achieve the same, if not better, outcomes with less resources, mm-hmm. and definitely less time inputs. Because I think a lot of what we do in construction, unfortunately, is wasteful.
And probably then, in this age, you know, more sustainable ultimately too. That's the other axis that's been brought in.
Without a shadow of a doubt, sustainability is a driving factor. To me, there is that link of, you know, innovation, sustainability and data. And if you get those three together, and collaboration from people in the industry, I think that's the way forward.
Right. The other thing, I suppose, when you look at it from yourselves and where you are now in terms of the size of the business, it's quite incredible that you have an Irish business competing on a global landscape with a list of customers that I could probably, you know, find thousands of people that will know all of them, and they're big and things. So give us a bit of an idea of how that business development worked over the years.
Yeah, I think it goes back to the last crash. I remember after the last crash, again, an Enterprise Ireland course I went on. It was construction-based. There was probably about 30 CEOs, whether it be in construction, MEP contractors, MEP designers, architects, and we're all fused together to say, well, how do we get out of this mess that we're all in around 2009, 2010? And a lot of us went abroad, and a lot of us tried to set up abroad, to some degrees of success, some better than others. We all did learn from each other, which was fantastic. And I suppose moving along from that, a lot of Irish companies looking for that USP, you know, found the data centre market. We had worked for a number of these foreign direct investment clients in Ireland, and we cut our teeth there. And it was something that we all had, whether it was design or construction, we all had a part of expertise in. And that has actually been exported very, very well. So you go around all of Europe, you're going to hear Irish accents, and it's something that we bring to jobs across Europe, and especially in the data centre sector. So it's that reliability, the trust, the dependability. I think some of we have a European network of 15 MEP consultancies. We share a lot of best practice across those different countries. Sometimes I look at what other countries offer engineering-wise, and they may have a better process. But then when that process breaks down, it's sometimes hard to fix. I think Irish companies are good at getting in, and if the process from A to B, if there's a block in there, they'll find a way to C, they'll find a way to D. And I think we as, you know, an industry abroad are very, very good. And I think that is the route to our success.
It's that idea of being agile in your approach to market.
Exactly, yeah. Agile and, you know, and flexible. And communication with the client, you know, sharing the problem, you know, rather than disguising the problem, putting it out there and showing a plan how you're going to get around it.
And in terms of the business itself, it's obviously been a story of organic growth rather than acquisition. Do you think the nature of the industry and the nature of the business that you've got means that going forward it's always going to be much more about organic growth and you driving rather than, you know, finding somebody and acquiring them or anything like that?
Yeah, up to now, the countries we're in, the 17, 18 different countries we're in, we've been able to follow our clients. We've been able to do most of our design from Ireland.
Okay.
We partner up through our European network with partners for localization to make sure our designs are locally compliant with local codes. And then we'll use, as well as us traveling back and forth, we'll use our partners for eyes and ears on the ground. So it works very well. When you go further afield, like there is opportunities for us in the States, maybe we're going to have to consider a different approach to that. An acquisition, maybe one.
The just the relationship with your customers, right? Again, it's the idea that can you, is it a real partner of equals when you're talking about these big DC, you know, the big data center companies, that they recognize and appreciate the skill set that you are bringing and the innovation that you are bringing, because, you know, you ultimately both have the same goal, that you want the best product building slash whatever you want out the other end of it?
Yeah, and I think it goes back to dependability. They need to depend on us. They have their own work, their own pressures. They need to know that they're actually being supported by their team. And whatever client there is, if it's a EMEA client, you're usually dealing with the same guys and girls from the client side across different countries.
Okay.
So we get used to working with each other. The challenge is then it's just a different set of rules for whatever playing field we're on at that time.
But that continuity between client staff and ETOS staff is really
exactly
important.
Yeah, and always the first one is it's getting to know each other, getting to know how we perform, and then as you're getting on to the second one, the third one, the fourth one, it really becomes hand in glove and a true team approach.
How do you feel about what you've already done in the company?
I'm absolutely delighted to where we've got to today. As I said, when we started off, the figure in my mind was 50 people, or 170 plus, were all those countries. I think we've built a very strong brand, a brand that we're very proud of with an ETOS. It's a brand that stands up internationally. So yes, I think the more we go on, the more opportunities that's opening up. So as we get bigger, more opportunities are coming our way. Mm. As we get bigger, we're putting in more systems that will help us. We're putting in more departments that will help us. So for me and the executive team, I think it's getting easier rather than harder as we expand. So yeah, I'm thoroughly enjoying it. We get great feedback from our staff, our people and talent team are constantly surveying our people, and we're getting great feedback that they're enjoying it as well. So to me, that's important, that our staff enjoy what they're doing, because I think if people enjoy what they're doing, they're going to give it their best.
Yeah. And when you qualified out of university and started the first job and things like that, was it always the plan to have your own business?
I think it was in there. There was a little there was something in the head that I would have liked to do it. I did work for some fantastic companies along the way. Probably looking back, yeah, I could have easily stayed with them. Mm. Glad I made the jump when I did, because opportunities came our way. And it's really, you know, to me, it's not about me. It's actually who I have surrounded myself with, and I've surrounded myself with some fantastic guys and girls that have really pushed ETOS forward.
And is there always an idea in when you talk to an awful lot of private companies about, you know, if you want your employees to act like owners, they need to be owners of a business. But an awful lot of times for private companies, that's very difficult. It's different when you're quoted on the stock exchange and you can give out share options and things like that. So how do you instill that kind of collective ownership, if you will, and in people?
I think it starts first with autonomy. Okay. I don't think it goes directly to ownership. Mm. I think, you know, you have to work together. You have to trust each other. You have to, on both sides, you have to deliver for each other. And then you get to a stage where you have the right guy or girl and you give them autonomy to start building their group and bringing in their own people to support them. And then eventually, I think that leads on to ownership.
You mentioned the help you've had from Enterprise Ireland and places like that, but you know, what have you learned from other executives or other companies that you may have come across or seen through the years?
Yeah, we like surround ourselves in different. We're part of Hosting Ireland, and there's about 50 different companies in there in the data center ecosystem in Ireland, and we share a lot of knowledge. And it's interesting, you know, if they may not even be on the engineering side of things, but are on in the DC sector, how much you'd actually learn from them. I think for our European network, I'm very good friends with the 15 CEOs, MEP CEOs. We meet twice a year in country. We take turns going to each other's country. And again, I learned so much from them of how they do business. Some of it the same, some of it a lot different than Ethos. So you try to cherry pick what may work for us and what may not. And then sometimes you do see an idea, you try it. What we're quite good at, we'll try something. If it fails, we'll move on, we'll drop it. And if you're going to fail fast,
yeah,
and move on. But yeah, and I think then going back to Enterprise Ireland, I think the facilitators we met through Enterprise Ireland have been a great sounding board for myself and the executive and the team leads in Ethos.
On a more personal level, obviously the industry has developed massively since Greg Hayden walked out of university all those years ago, right?
A long time ago,
exactly, yeah. Could you go back and do the day job if you had to?
Yeah, I still think though my the people I work with in Ethos and
might have a different idea.
Different view, yeah. But I was a very good design engineer. That's what got me to here, I think. I was also a very good commissioning engineer, and I didn't go straight to after my leaving cert. I'd done my degree part time. Okay. Finished it in the UK. What that allowed me to do was work. You know, I liked earning money at the tender age of 18. Mm-hmm. And I could learn better when I could apply things. So because I was working in the field and also studying in the field, one helped the other greatly for me. So yeah, I think I was a very good commissioning engineer, very good design engineer. I still get involved with problems day to day.
Okay.
When they do get to me, because we have some super people, they are really difficult
problems.
Yeah. Luckily enough, then there's not too many. But like I have no problem rolling up the sleeves and if I can help out and I can, you know, add anything to it to come to a solution a lot quicker, yeah, I'm happy to do that.
What do you do in your spare time?
I look after three kids. I've and two dogs. I have three kids under 10, and they keep me young. So they're very, very energetic. And the two dogs are 12. They're quite energetic for two old dogs. So yeah, I enjoy that. Then other than that, I love CrossFit. I love running. I didn't realize I was a decent runner until COVID came and the gyms closed.
Oh, so,
and I found it was okay. And I love skiing.
Okay.
Diving. Again, I was a rescue diver back in the day, but haven't done as much as that since the kids have come. But yeah, I keep myself busy. I like keeping myself busy outside of work.
Good. We're hoping we have an awful lot of younger listeners on. So, what What advice, A, would you give to your younger self now, right? And what would you get advice would you give to young people in general now?
I probably have to say start with you. And what I mean by that is I remember I went to Marian College. There was a career guidance day, and one of the parents that was there said to me that work hard today or work hard for the rest of your life. And that sort of shocked me. And I was sort of a little bit of a messer up to that. And this, I was probably in fifth year, sixth year. So I was thinking, I haven't got that long to go before leaving school. And it sort of woke me up. And so I did try work hard. I worked hard when I was young. So I would say to someone, like, work hard when you're young. It does get easier. Give it that little 1% extra every day to be the better you. And just make yourself relevant, you know, put your hand up, you know, look for those tasks. I think that's important.
So challenge yourself wherever you can.
Yeah.
We have a closing tradition in this show where I open up this black book in front of me and there's a question in it from a previous guest. They don't know who the question was going to be asked of, and you don't, and I'm not going to tell you who asked it, right? But your question is, why do you do what you do, and what would you do if you were doing something different?
That's very good, very good. I fell into engineering. I wanted to be a vet. I was told by teachers that no, there's no way to be a vet. Well, they told my dad, and my dad stuck up for me. They told my dad that I'd be a dustbin collector, but I could have been the biggest dustbin collector in Europe.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
So there's nothing wrong with that. But so then after school, I got into technical drawing and I just found my way into engineering, and it's been very, very good to me. But then between the vet and the technical drawing, it's probably an architect. I would have loved, and, you know, I think I have, maybe I don't, mm-hmm. think I have that flair for design and creativity. So probably not too far away from what I do now.
Very good. Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Greg Hayden. It's been very good to give his time. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe and comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and we'll see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.